So I will speak for all of us and say, these are the cutest babies ever. See, they all thought so. Okay, so my name is Genevieve, and I was born in 1960, because you all wanted to know. We all look at each other and go, oh, I wonder. And the reason I tell you that is because you want context. You want to know, okay, you want to know how thick the polyester was on my prom dress. I know. You young people don't even know how it was. But anyway, it was hideous. And but you also want to know contextually how much of the last century, how much of the, especially, you know, the disintegration of the family, the sexual revolution, the chaos, the nuttiness, and everything else like that. You kind of want to know where I fit into all of that. You know, whether I'm the age of your mother, age of your daughters, age of your sisters. You know, usually we're all the same age, but I'm getting so old that you all are so young now. So yes, I'm the age of your mother. Okay, so I'm a convert to the church. And so when I went off to college in 1978, do the math, it's the right year, that was my college rebellion. Not that there weren't other rebellions that were not so good, but that was my college rebellion. I always wanted to be Catholic. And when you are young and don't have a driver's license and can't really rig it, you don't know how to do that. But once I got to college, I could be Catholic. And so, but my driving question since the very beginning was always, what does it mean to be made to the image and likeness of God as a woman? I just didn't understand that question. And the reason was I was kind of a clunky person. It wasn't that I was a jock or athletic or anything. I was just a total nerd. And yes, I love babies, but I didn't feel very mothery. I'm doing this girl thing wrong. I just didn't feel very normal as a woman. And I wanted to know once I came into the church. So I also, another fun fact, very finite amount of energy. So with that finite amount of energy, I wanted to make sure I was doing it right. Whatever I was going to do, I was going to do the right things. So a lot of reading, a lot of studying, you know, took a long time of, you know, when I came into the church in the 80s, you know, think about it. I thought, what have I joined? It's like Nuttyville. You all who are old enough. And it was like, you know, because I was a history major, and I was thinking, you know, Middle Ages, and I was thinking, you know, all this, you know, rampant beauty, you know, for the taking. And you come into a church as polyester as I was, and I'm like, oh, I thought it would be more than this. Anyway, with the papacy of John Paul II and that whole unfolding of so many beautiful theological truths, you know, I began to understand more and more and more. And finally, I understood through the work of many, many great writers that the vocation of woman is simply to be an icon of Holy Mother Church. Every church you go into is different, just as all of you do it differently than your mother, than your sister, than your grandmother, than your daughters. There's room in this church for everybody. And what I did, the first book I wrote was The Authentic Catholic Woman. And what this does is simply, in a very practical Germanic sense, lays it out. Seven sacraments, four marks of the church, church's mother and teacher, builder of culture, buries the dead. You know, all the things that church does. Everything the church does on a transcendent sacramental plane, we do in a practical way. And we each do it very differently. And so we don't need to worry about the woman sitting next to us. You have a different husband, you have a different house, you have a different income, you have a different skill set, you have a different vocation. You know, it's different. It's different. And then everybody can just relax and just do it according to her lights, according to her state in life. And it changes over the years. There's plenty of room. Everyone on the planet, from beginning to the end of the time, fits into this paradigm. That's what we're called to do. So there's a quote in here. What did I say, 1960. Okay, there's a quote in here from Mulieris Dignitatem. Oh, BT Dubs. That book is Daughters of St. Paul, an outline of Mulieris Dignitatem that I did as a study guide. If you get this one, it also has a study guide, but you have to email me, and I'll just send you the text, and then you can print it out for your book club or whatever else like that. Okay, so John Paul II and Mulieris Dignitatem wrote this. In God's eternal plan, woman is the one in whom the order of love in the created world of persons first takes root. When the author of the letter to the Ephesians calls Christ the bridegroom and the church the bride, he indirectly confirms through this analogy the truth about woman as bride. The bridegroom is the one who loves. The bride is loved. It is she who receives love in order to love in return. That quote just knocked my socks off, because what it says is there are all kinds of different hierarchies in the world. And in all of those hierarchies, or for the most part, the men come first. That's fine. That's fine. We're all obedient wives, right? We're great. Doing that very well. And so this hierarchy puts woman first in the most important hierarchy of all, the hierarchy of love. So anytime a woman does not love, there is some part of the world that is diminished by her inability to love. Now, why wouldn't a woman love? Well, one is just, you know, your garden variety selfishness. I mean, this happens all the time. We're fallen people. We sin. Your cranky little souls don't want to love people. You're tired. You're distracted. You're like, oh, it's just this gift of self is just too hard. But secondly is what Father Wagner talked about in the first talk, about human experience. The difficulty is that your darling little skippy hearts bounced up to the people you loved it from childhood on, and you did not receive love in return. You poured out your heart to friends, to family, to all kinds of people that you met, and you were shocked at the unloving response. And so over the years, you said, whoa, 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 whoa. I'm not stupid. To love is to suffer. And some of these injuries were horrific. They were horrific. And you said, no, I'm not going to love. It's too painful. And so you put this little lock around your heart, and you boxed it in tightly, and you said, I'm going to be very, very careful about who I love, because I've had my teeth kicked in so many times that I have to be careful. I have to look out for myself. Okay, that's understandable. That's our normal human experience in a fallen world. And yet, when the disciples asked our Lord how to pray, he gave them the Our Father. And the money quote in the Our Father concerning our eternal salvation says, forgive us our trespasses as we forgive those who trespass against us. We can't get around it. We have to forgive in order to receive the forgiveness of God, in order to have eternal life. And I'm a little cranky myself, because this is the most important thing on planet Earth for people to do, is to forgive, and nobody tells us how to do it. Hence the second book. I'll do this. What I did in my very academic and Germanic way was I took this whole thing apart and I said, how does one forgive? And that's what I want to share with you today. Because in order for us to love, we have to forgive. In order for us to forgive, we have to understand a lot about human nature, a lot about how forgiveness works, the theology behind it, and everything else like that. So, what do we have to forgive? Absolutely everyone who has injured us in any way. Anyone. These can be things that are large, they can be small, they can be deliberate, they can be, just not deliberate. They could be personal, they could have been, you know, huge and impersonal, it doesn't matter. Anybody who has injured you in any way requires your forgiveness. Okay? Anything. And so the difficulty is where to begin. I usually say start small, because the little things, you know, obviously are easier to forgive. The larger things, we, for the sake of surviving in a day-to-day life, we've often buried. Okay, so one of my daughters read a book, and the book was utterly inconsequential, but the title was great. Men are waffles and women are spaghetti. The thing is that everything up here, our brains are very, very different, and so everything up here is a tangled mess, And so if you touch on the injury, all kinds of other things go haywire. I mean, back in the day, my husband knew I would start to have a meltdown, you know, sometime around middle of November. Because as you're thinking about the gifts and thinking about the visits and thinking about the people and everything else like that, all of the stuff would start to come up. And this is, and I would wander around. He's like, he didn't know how to help because he was like, is it gifts? Make a list, you know, or do you want me to mail them up? What? And he didn't understand the female brain was just that family was just emerging from where I had buried them at the bottom of the barrel, and they were starting to come up, and all these injuries were starting to stew. I can remember when I when a friend helped me through one particular injury, I had to give my children, they were little at the time, give them to someone else, you know, during the day for a couple days because I was so fragile doing this work. So yes, I can understand you might want to start small, you might want to start larger, however you do. But the thing is that the way the brain is all mashed together, we're tricky. That's what I always say is I don't talk to men because they're so compartmentalized that this talk doesn't mean anything to them. They don't operate the way we do. You know, if your husband or your brother has a beef with somebody, he don't want to talk about it, you know, or you say, should we do something? You know, he stuffed it, put it in a drawer, closed it, gone. And you're thinking, okay, maybe a spiritual director or maybe somebody will, I don't know. It's not for us to meddle in their lives on those points. But we know they do it very differently than we do it. Okay, so absolutely everything has to be forgiven. When you get to the big things, sometimes it helps to have a friend. Now, a friend needs to be, as Father said, in a state of grace, wise, discreet, prudent, all the wonderful virtues that are going to allow her to listen with a very helpful ear. So you have a version of events, and she might ask you a question out of the blue that you never even considered before. Or as I used to do with a particular event, people would say, whoa, that's, you know, I would just say it very blithely, very nonchalantly, this happened. They were like, whoa, that's, I'm like, oh, no, you don't understand. And I would just dismiss it. I would explain it away. And they would all be like, that's really weird. And I go, oh, no, you don't understand the people. This is how they operate, and this. And I would defend it because I wasn't willing to really face that particular thing as horrific as it was. Because once it does penetrate of what happens to you, what happened to you at that time, my worst injury, it took me four children, and the fourth child to reach age six when it happened, for me to understand how horrific this thing was. Nothing sexual. It was just a chaos in family, and something bad happened. And I, for some reason, one day I looked at her and I said, you know, imagine what if it had happened to her. And I was floored. I couldn't see it in myself, but I could see it in this child of what if it had happened to her. And I was overcome. That's what a good friend will do. She will love you and hear this and cry for you and say, that was horrible. So many times we've had to soldier our way through life, like, no, it was fine, it was fine. I got through it and everything else. I remember another friend said, where was Jesus at that moment? And I said, well, it was in a car. I was going somewhere during the event. And I said, he was saying, hang on, kid, it's going to be a tough few years. She's like, no, he was beating on the car door. He was saying, stop, stop. I'm like, but he didn't, but it all just took place. And she said, but she was trying to get me to understand how bad this was when I was being very stoic about it because that's what I needed to do in order to get through, you know, childhood after that point. Sometimes a friend sees things so much better than you do. Now, she's blind about her own life. That's where you come in. But with your life, she sees all this stuff and she says, no. Or that's a very odd response. And so you're so close to these people, whether they're family or friends or coworkers or something else like that, for her to pull you up short and say, that's an odd way to respond. You can look at it and you say, yeah. So the extra set of eyes are really, really helpful in some of this. I was unable to do this for a long time because of a misunderstanding of the sin of detraction. And if I thought if I revealed the sins of others, that was a sin myself. And then I understood that this is not detraction. This is not gossip. This is you sitting down in order to try to make sense of sin and to heal so that you can be a better person to love these people in the future. That's all it is. The intention needs to be pure. The discretion needs to be absolute. You have to be very, very sure that this person is never going to betray this. And as this happens more and more in your life, you'll choose well. Other people will begin to choose you. And I don't want to put this on the level of the sacrament of penance, but this is the closest that I've come with what people have revealed to me. And I, as the recipient, just take this to the tabernacle and I just go, oh, good Lord. As in, good Lord. Like, you know, because it's just TTG, to the grave, is where you take this stuff. It gives you a focus in your prayer life to try to help these people. And of course, your friends are going to pray for you as well. So you've taken this to them. And I always say you don't forgive too quickly. You just don't forgive too quickly. I don't know what to do about the scripture that says, don't take your anger. What is that one? That sunset thing, yeah. Because some stuff takes a long time to process. It just does. And sometimes you're going to be grieving a very long time. Now, yes, grief is not anger, but there are waves of anger. There are waves of anger when you actually see fully what people have done to you. And you've got to work that through. So a lot of tears. A lot of tears, layers and layers like an onion of tears and tears and tears. And then either yourself, you'll come to this conclusion, or your friend will gently say, it's time to forgive. So, how does one forgive? You can speak to the friend, you can go to the tabernacle, you can do it however you wish. And this is how it goes. You ready? I forgive. Really easy. I forgive so-and-so for this. That's it. And then you take your darling, cute, beautiful self off to confession. Me, the victim? Yes. You, the victim. For the years you did not forgive. The years of bitterness and resentment. I know you didn't know how to forgive. I know you didn't have the tools. I know you were overwhelmed. I know you were distracted. I know you were frustrated. I mean, there's so many reasons. The difficulty is, in the confessional, I've never had an actual spiritual director in a confessional, but my guess is it's just going to be a priest. You keep it short and you keep it sweet. I forgive my friend Donna for betraying some of my innermost secrets in junior high. That's it. And I have borne bitterness and resentment against her for 32 years. Okay, that's it. You can add, for in all the sins of my past life, I'm truly sorry, blah, 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 and you walk out. Don't make it too complicated. You might not even want to say that about what? I have held bitterness and resentment against my friend Donna for 32 years. I'm terribly sorry. Because once you get into why, and then you try to explain yourself, it gets all confusing, and it sounds like you're trying to justify yourself. I don't know your culpability. I don't know your level of resentment. I don't know how much bitterness there actually has been. But the thing is that you have to forgive everything, and until that moment, you didn't forgive. That's all. So it's a rather simple process. You bring out the injury, alone or with a friend. You grieve the injury. You look at it from all the different sides. Do not minimize it. Do not minimize it. This is not the time to say, she probably didn't mean it. Oh, maybe I misunderstood something. You know, you forgive the sin at its worst. She did mean it. You did not misunderstand. This was a horrific event. This was bad. let's say there's something like pornography in the home growing up. Okay, so there's toxicity in that house. Your brothers are acting weird. You're acting weird. Your mother's acting weird. It's just, you know, the kids are going to run across it. This is back in the day with, you know, those magazines, the girly magazines and stuff like that. It's very different now. But let's go back to our generation. What are you forgiving? You have to forgive your father for bringing this toxin into the home. You have to forgive your mother for enabling it and not pitching them or pitching a fit or whatever she's going to do to keep it out if she can. You have to forgive your brothers for acting on it. You have to forgive all kinds of different things. Okay? You forgive it at its worst. Later, you may begin to understand it differently. But that's, a lot of people take a big thing and they try to make it, break it down into bite-sized pieces and pretend it was something small in order to forgive. No, you have to forgive the big stuff because it was wrong. Now, forgiveness does not preclude justice. I love the encounter with that John Paul II had with Mehmet Ali Aga, the man who had tried to assassinate him. There's that beautiful picture of the two of them in the far side at the prison, and it looks like confession. They have their heads together and they're speaking very closely together. And when he came out, John Paul, you know, they asked him, you know, what he had said, and he said, "I said I forgive you for shooting me." And then what? And he says, "Well, will you ask them to let me out?" He said, "No, you shot me." It was like, you belong in prison. I mean, I'm sure he said it in a very nice way, but the thing is that you can't preclude justice. There have to be consequences for actions. We're not asking you to short circuit anything. Back in the day of TV, I had a weekly show. That's why I'm here. Peter Morgan. Oh, he's great. He was my producer. Anyway, so there was one show I never aired. Actually, I never even taped it. It was. I did a quick chat beforehand, and it was the woman who was the head of Rape Crisis for Rhode Island. Rhode Island's this big, so there's one Rape Crisis. I think it was called Women in the Church Today. I forget what the name of the show was. And so it was meant to be a Catholic show. I said, "So do you bring the women to forgiveness in this program?" And she said, "I don't think you understand what these women have suffered." I said, "I think I do." So we talked a little bit, and then I said, "Are you telling me that nowhere in your program do you talk about forgiveness?" She said, "If I asked them to forgive, they'd get up and walk out on me." I said, "We can't tape the show." I said, "This isn't going to work." And so, you know, we said our goodbyes, and I wrote a letter to the bishop, and I said, "I want you to know that there is no forgiveness," because this is, as I said, the only rape crisis, so the diocese was donating to it as well. We know those women who make horrible choices, and we know those women who have actually taken up with abusive men. Or abusive women. Lesbian relationships are actually the most violent relations out there. And the thing is, when they go through a bad spot and the one runs to the crisis center, that's when she needs to forgive. She needs to have a woman sit there and cry with her, remind her how much dignity she actually has, and bring her to forgiveness. The problem is she doesn't. And she finally just says, "Oh, I guess I was overreacting, I was overreacting," and then she runs right back. Or if she doesn't run back to him, she runs back to somebody worse. The thing about forgiveness is, once you have forgiven, the scales fall from your eyes. That's when you make a life's change. When she forgives him, then she sees, nobody deserves to be treated like that. You belong in jail. You have attacked my children. You have done drugs in the same apartment building with my children. You know, she sees all this stuff and she goes ballistic, and then she presses charges and they hold. It's counterintuitive. She can't see the truth about the injury until after she has forgiven it. There's a question about reconciliation. The funny thing is when you reconcile is when you realize how toxic things really are. As I say, that's when the life changes comes. I remember one family member who was very, very toxic in our life. When I finally forgave her, everything changed. And we won't be visiting, and I won't be sending my children, and we're not going to be doing this. And you know what? We're staying home this Christmas. Everything changed. I loved her probably more than ever, but I realized I had been rushing back out of guilt and all kinds of wrong, unhealthy motivations because I was Christian and I had to just sit there and have a kick me sign on the back of my, no. You are setting an example for your children about what makes healthy relationships. And when they see you keep going back and engaging in an unhealthy relationship, they're really confused, and it's not a good selling point for Christianity. It's just not. They go, this is Christianity? Just being a doormat? Christianity is not being a doormat. I'll explain the difference in a minute. So, sometimes there's going to be a reconciliation, and sometimes they're not. There is not going to be one. You're setting your boundaries differently. You say, can I still engage with this person and not enable him or her in bad behavior? Because that's what you've done. When you've willingly carried on a toxic relationship, you're allowing that person to sin on a regular basis. And you're a party to the sin. You forgive, you recalibrate, the scales fall from your eyes, and you say, oh, things have to be different for a whole bunch of reasons. And that's wonderful. And your children see that. And they see that you don't allow people to treat them without dignity or to lack respect for what should be a proper relationship. That's very, very important to do that. Question about an apology. Do you wait for an apology? Absolutely not. Because if you're waiting for an apology, that person owns you. And that apology may never come. Or it may come in such a form that it's actually an insult or a twist of the knife because they don't get how much they hurt you. And that hurts almost more than the original thing. The person may be dead. It could have been anonymous, you know, a driver on the road that, you know, caused an accident or something. You'll never know who that person is. The injuries during war, you don't know who dropped the bomb on your head, killed all your children. Like I say, everything has to be forgiven. Everything. The beautiful thing is this is extremely easy when you trust in God's mercy and that God will take care of this. Let me just give you an example. Let's say, back to the junior high betrayal, Linda betrayed Susan. Okay, Linda and Susan have been friends since, you know, way, way back, even, you know, preschool. They get to junior high. Linda wants to be in with the cool crowd, and somehow or another, she betrays something of importance to Susan. And Susan walks into lunchroom one day, and all girls are looking at her, and she's just mortified, and then it comes to her that some silly little confidence was betrayed. There's nothing silly in junior high. It's like, oh, you know, you remember junior high. And so, you know, she's crushed. You know, a few years go by and the friendship is never the same. Okay. She has to forgive Linda. As it is. No excuses. She has to forgive Linda. And there's going to come a point, she doesn't have to wait for Linda to apologize. She at some point simply has to say the words, I forgive Linda. And then she has to go to confession and just say, I have borne resentment against a childhood friend. That's all she needs to say. And if she can do that, she is right with God. Okay? Now, Imagine she cannot get past it. She's just crushed. This was a very special junior high, and there were very special people in that lunchroom. You know, whatever, she can't get past it. Linda comes to her senses, is mortified, and, you know, sends her notes and, you know, stuffed animals and tickets to shows, and I'm so sorry. And she makes reparations as best she can. Linda's right with God, and Susan's not. Isn't that weird? The one who injured is set for heaven, you know, in the small picture, and Susan is not, even though she was the injured party. When you think about this, it's very much a mathematical equation. Either Linda apologizes and is right with God, Susan apologizes, or Susan forgives and is right with God, neither of them need to do what they need to do, and neither is right with God, or Susan forgives, Linda apologizes and make reparation. And the interesting thing is, and this is where we move forward in forgiveness, their relationship is transformed. Transformed. Another question about forgiveness is, should I forget? Forgetting is not normal. I think it's called dementia or Alzheimer's. It's not normal. We don't want to forget things. But it's transformed. It's transformed. It's something else. The relationship between Linda and Susan, if they both do what they ought, is transformed to another plane. They both know suffering, each from the different angle of that injury. They both know mercy. They both know forgiveness. They both know the value of friendship. They both know how precious is somebody who will go through a trial with you and come out the other end transformed. The thing about it is, as I said earlier, the scales fall from your eyes, but all the injuries are transformed and they're touchstones of wisdom for you. Because when you begin to do this over and over, you're going to stockpile these memories and you're going to stockpile these experiences and you're going to stockpile your amount of trust in God's grace to take these horrific things and change them into opportunities to grow and to love, so that when someone comes to you, you're going to be able to reach into that storehouse of wisdom and say with absolute sincerity, yes, I understand. We don't want to forget these things. And when Mary was confronted by some of the perplexing things about Jesus, there is this phrase in the Bible that says, she pondered all these things in her heart. A woman who spoke Greek had explained to me that that word ponder is the same word that would use if you pulled a hot potato out of the oven and you were tossing it from hand to hand, as we do, like, you know, get there. That's pondering. She wasn't in a reverie going, oh, and a sword will pierce your heart, oh. She was tossing that hot potato going, huh, that's a little daunting. You know, we can't understand her immaculate heart. I mean, she obviously was light years beyond us. But she was tossing those ideas around in a vibrant way. The thing is that we can turn these events around. And as I say, the scales fall from your eyes. You gather a stockpile of wisdom. You've looked over enough of these injuries and you say, wow, life is really complicated. I had mentioned a toxic person in my family. I am now, pushing 60. I understand. I understand she's a wounded soul. I understand the things that may have gone wrong in her childhood. I'm not sure, but I see some of the signs. All of a sudden, I understand why she may have been unable to love the way she ought to have loved. It is what it is. You can't get that before the forgiveness. Like I say, you don't want to chew it down to size and then say, oh, it was no big deal, or it was, you know, it wasn't what I thought or anything, or she's a wounded soul. No. Anybody, as let's say a 6-year-old, a 12-year-old, a, you know, whatever, deserves love. And the fact that there was a deficit of love when you needed love is sad. That's what you're forgiving. Now, fast forward to the gray hair, white hair, whatever it is. You say, oh, I understand. Poor dear. She must have been very unhappy herself. Okay, fine. That's the wisdom that comes through this. If you will simply allow God to work through you and to do this work of forgiveness. There's another phrase. I did some bullet points of things I didn't want. This is usually a weekend long retreat, and I'm just fast forwarding. Forgiving yourself. This is the bluntest thing I'm going to say to you, and I'm terribly sorry, but I have to tell you this. There is no such thing as forgiving yourself. You cannot forgive yourself. Either you are guilty or you are innocent. Okay? We as Catholics don't believe in shame. We look guilt in the face, and if you are guilty, you go to confession if you have done something wrong. There's no innocent half of yourself to forgive the guilty half of yourself. It's a nice, pious phrase, but it's metaphysically impossible. What do we mean when we say, I can't forgive myself? Dear ladies, what you're saying is, my standards are higher than that. I don't normally do things like that. I am a better person than that. What that behavior exhibited at that particular moment. No, you're not. You did it. I'm sorry. It's a pious phrase to explain that I'm normally a good person and that was really out of character. I love that comment that Father Wagner said about the man who was in Vietnam. He said, just watch out. I could betray you at any moment. He knew what he was worth. We're worms and no man. We're that lowest moment, that's who we are. And you're trying to signal to people that I'm better than that. That was just a one-off. Or I'm so embarrassed. I'm so ashamed that I actually... You know, okay, when people say that around you, okay, it's very hard. You can't call them out. You just kind of, whatever. But I don't want any of you to ever say that. You can't forgive yourself. Only God can forgive you. If you're wrong, confess it. Okay? And, you know, try to do better next time. But don't try to signal to everybody that you're actually better than your worst action. Remember what Father Wagner said. God loved us first, and that's why we're good. He didn't love us because we're good. And we're always trying to wiggle around that truth about earning God's love. He just loves us. You know, when we look at these little babies, you say, oh, that's why he loves us, because they're just edible. They're just the cutest. And that's what he thinks of us at our worst moment. He just loves us. He just loves us, not because we're cute. Okay, so I think I got my bullet points. Okay. When you are older and wiser and you've been through this many, many times over and over and over, it's not that you become bulletproof. Is that you become transparent. These kids are perfect, but okay, in 2 years they won't be perfect. And so they're going to be on the floor and just wailing around and just, you know, having this temper tantrum. And if you stop and you pick up the child and you're going to say, you know, like, we're perfect parents. Oh, you can do this in your room. Fine. You know, because we don't have any of it. We don't give in. We aren't thinking like, we pick up the child to take them to a room and have your temper tantrum in the room. But on the way back to the bedroom, the foot goes, you know, and just kicks you in the shin. It's a two-year-old. He didn't mean it. And you know that. Yes, it hurts. But would any of us hold this against the child for years and years? You know, back when you were two, you kicked me in the shin. I'm like, that's just silly stuff. We don't do that. It's the same with all the sins against us. This is where you become utterly, utterly transformed by the injuries because... All right, let me tell you. Well, no, here's my worst day. This is my worst day. I have five kids. Child one was cohabitating. Child two was in jail. Child three, throwing things around the house, looking at me, she goes, I'm going to be a Buddhist. Okay, I lost it. I lost it. I just want you to know I'm like the Velveteen Rabbit. I'm like so real. And I, you know, we buckets and buckets and buckets of tears. I'm like, you know, there's this scripture like raise the children the way they should go and they will not. I'm like, what is that, God? I mean, this isn't going according to the plan. And, you know, we were a fun family. I mean, we were daily mass and homeschooling and all this kind of stuff. We were fun. And, okay, that's one, two, three. You heard him. Okay. So child number three went to the local college, University of Rhode Island, went behind our backs. She really, really didn't like it. And she came home and she goes, I'm going to Steubenville. I'm like, Steubenville? Okay. And so she goes to Steubenville. She's in Sacrifice of Love. She's just like the queen of Steubenville. She just loves it. And I'm like, oh my gosh. So later I said, remember that day you told me you were going to be a Buddhist? She goes, oh, I was just mad at you that day. She was a temper tantrum baby kicking me in the shin. This is what you begin to understand about every injury on planet Earth. We're all children. We're all children just acting out and lashing at whoever's closest to us because we're broken and we're angry and we're frustrated and we're disappointed and we're just sinful. Now, you know, talk about the bomb. When the bomb drops on your house and all your kids are dead, yeah, that's some pretty dangerous children out there. You have to forgive it all. The thing is that, as I said at the beginning, we stand as an icon of Holy Mother Church. If that's how they treated the bridegroom, how do you think they're going to treat us? We are two in one flesh. And the thing is that the more that we put on Christ, the more we imitate our spouse, the more we purify ourselves, the thing is sometimes it draws more fire. And we, I don't know, there's this radar out there where people in a state of grace are very annoying to people who are not in a state of grace. It's hard to explain. You know, people just crank on you and like, what? They just know. This is the spiritual battle that's out there. You can't take this stuff seriously. You can't. You can't. Life is very long. And all things work unto good for those who love God. That means all things. Yes, when that bad thing happened at 6 years old, Jesus didn't shrug his shoulders and say, it'll be a bad few years. He was beating on the car window. He does despise sin with a passion. But what's the worst thing that could possibly happen? Oh, I know what that is. Incarnation. God comes to love us and we kill him. Oh, that's pretty bad. And that was the salvation of the world. Your injuries are the very same avenues for grace. They simply are. You simply have to take your wounds and plaster them to Jesus' wounds on the cross. Remember how we tell an authentic revelation of Jesus from an inauthentic one is when he comes, you look for the wounds. So if Jesus came to, let's say, a mystic, and she looks and there's no wounds there, she says, get behind me, Satan. This is not true. In his glorified body, Jesus had the wounds. Remember, he asked Thomas to put his hand in his side. In his side. We've had a few babies in this room, right? Can you imagine anybody touching you after? You're like, oh! In his side. The thing is that thus far in my life, there is not an injury that I cannot reveal and probe and share and rejoice in. Because you're going to go from white-knuckling it through life to saying, okay, there's an avenue for my pain. Okay, fine. To, oh, okay, this is what we want to do in order to guarantee we're always in a state of grace and we're good with God. We're always going to forgive too. Absolutely rejoicing in these injuries. I promise you. Okay, this is a funny thing. Half the chapters in this book are me. You don't know which chapters. I rejoice in them. And this is the beauty of it. This is what our Blessed Mother knew. I always say, don't forgive too quickly. She of the Immaculate Heart could forgive immediately while the blood was still dripping on her when he said, behold your children. She said, sure, I got it. While the blood was still wet. We take time. We need time. We're fallen. We're puny. We're just so pathetic. We really are. But we have to help each other to do this. We have to teach our children to forgive. It's a delicate, delicate matter because you can't just bulldoze in. You're dealing with wounded hearts. And you think about how you might have received this message on your worst day. You have to make sure that you're forgiving the right people. You know what is irritating when let's say there's a public transgression. Let's say a drunk driver in the neighborhood runs over a little kid. And everybody rushes to that family and says, oh, we forgive, we know, we forgive. And there's the family with the dead body going, what? There's a hierarchy around it. It's not for us to forgive him. It's the parents of the child to forgive him. And so we have to be very delicate about how we go about this. You know, take it before the Blessed Sacrament. The thing is if you have a girlfriend who mentions something two or three times over the years, God doesn't, well, hey. You might want to probe it just a little bit. You know how you always talk about your older brother? Can we talk about that? You know, whatever it is. And, you know, it's a tricky business because you're prying open wounds that make you incapable of functioning in the short term. So imagine you have scoliosis. And so with the scoliosis, you have a way of getting up and down stairs. You have a way of getting through the grocery store and kind of slinging the stuff into your car. You have a way of doing everything in your house. And someone comes along and says, I know there's a way of straightening your spine. And the person says, no, I get through life. I'm fine. Well, let's say they've got a half life or a three quarters life. And you say, but you can have a straight spine. And they're like, no, I've got this rigged. I know how to do everything. You're offering people freedom, absolute freedom. Because like I said, back in the day, you know, when November came around, I'd start to go wobbly and wiggy and then get very, very unpleasant, very snappish and peevish. It was just the family thing would just come up and I didn't know how to deal with it. None of that stuff bothers me. None of it. None of it. The thing is, I'm utterly free. And you know people, sometimes in a workplace or you know people in your neighborhood or in your family, and there are these topics where you can't go because they'll just fly off the handle. You're free. Once you do this, the world's your oyster. You're not afraid of anything. But you're not running out like a crazy person either. You're there. You're this wise, wise woman. You're a true icon of the church, which is the repository of all the wisdom of God. She was the firstborn of God who danced with him at the foundation of the world. That's Lady Wisdom. That was the forerunner, the foreshadower of Holy Mother Church. That's who you're called to be. And you can't have these spots, these areas where you, these no-go zones in your life, because the world needs you. I'm going to read another quote, and this one is from, I know you all have heard it, from the Second Vatican Council, the closing documents. You know the doc, you know the phrase. It's in the world in such a desperate state. Women imbued with the spirit of the gospel are called to save mankind from falling. Okay. Remember I said at the beginning, in the order of love, woman comes first. at this age in the world, the love of woman is going to save the culture. We can't have you walking wounded. We can't have you living half lives. We can't have you crippled by past injuries. We have tremendous confusion when it comes to sexuality. We have tremendous confusion when it comes to the definition of marriage. We have tremendous confusion when it comes to the truths of the church. We have people, the bulk of people in this country are not going to darken the door of a church. You are the icon of that church. You are taking it to them. You have that tabernacle light burning in your heart where Christ resides. You have those open doors that's willing to embrace anyone. You are going to be the face of the church in a world that thinks that the church is nothing but benighted, bigoted haters. And you have to show a different, loving, maternal face. And when that person is ready, and when you begin healing the hearts, you gently lead them, just as it's through Jesus to Mary, is going to be through you to Father when they're ready for confession. You have to be healed. You have to be whole. This work is your work. And this time is your time. We all know the disintegration, the lights dimming all around us. Your lamps have to be lit. Your little lamps have to be full of oil. You have to be stockpiling wisdom to get us through this next dark age. It depends on you, and the work begins with forgiveness. I'm happy to talk to anybody over the course of this weekend. And then I will leave my email address with Peter or with one of the consecrated women, and I'm at your disposal. This is my life's work at this point, and I'm here for you. God bless you.